So I just pulled out a couple of cards from my Oracle deck. It's kind of fun. I quite like the idea of divination. You know, in my work as a healer, I often use divinatory techniques to kind of find out bits of information. And these little Oracle decks, they're kind of nice. They're kind of lighthearted and they're beautifully illustrated. And this one I've got here is called the Earthbound Oracle. I can't remember the guy's name who created it, but I'm sure if you Google the Earthbound Oracle, you'll be able to find out. It's just a set of lovely little cards, and I quite like just pulling one out at the start of the day just to see if there's any resonance with what's going on for the day. And I thought I'd just pull out a couple for this little introduction tonight. And two cards just leapt out of the pack and fell over onto the table. So I figured, right, okay, I'll go with those ones. And we've got Perseverance, which is depicted by a leaping salmon by the look of it, leaping out of the water. And then we've got Permanence, which is depicted by a quill and pot of ink with several blots of faded ink in the background. Perseverance and Permanence, so they're the themes of today's little introduction. And you're listening to the Lumieres podcast. My name's Jody, and we keep growing slowly. This is episode number 4, and we've got a few hundred listeners now, which is great. I hope you're all enjoying the conversations. There's plenty more to come. Today's is a very special one with Dr. Martin Shaw, the mythologist, storyteller, and author. And this was recorded in Devon at his house. He very kindly made time for me to come down and sit down and record that conversation. And, it's a pretty special one. He is a very interesting man. He's dedicated his life to being an interpreter of the liminal spaces between modern culture and, you could say, the language of nature or the language of myth. And as you'll hear, he's a fascinating man, and he's got a lot of very important things to say, I think, especially given the madness that we seem to be swirling around in from week to week on a international level. Martin's a very strong proponent of just reconnecting to the small things, the small gods that are all around us in every day. And this is something that I have resonated with, you know, for years and years. The way we appreciate the small things in our day-to-day life, you know, watching a robin land on a leafless branch outside the window and just admiring the colours and pausing in the middle of the day to just feel the sun on our skin. These little pleasures of being alive, you know, and these are magical moments which we can all stop to appreciate, hopefully, at some point in our day. Yeah, there's a chat with Martin coming up, and I thought just read a little passage from his latest book, Scatterlings, for you, which is highly recommended. I've been talking about it. I talked about it a bit in the previous episode with Sarah Janes, and we touch a bit on some of the themes in the podcast. So this is a little passage from Scatterlings, and then we'll be straight into a chat with Martin Shaw. The next episode coming up for you is also a great one. It's with Dr. David Luke, the psychologist, psychedelic explorer. He is a very lovely man, and he is also as busy as they, all these busy guys. They're so busy putting out all these wonderful things for you to read and for you to attend and for you to learn. You know, these are people who are truly, I'm truly honored, who've made time for me to come and chat to. And hopefully you guys will love that one too. That's in a couple of weeks' time with Dr. David Luke. Right now we've got Dr. Martin Shaw coming up. I'll leave you with a passage from Scatterlings. If I'd believed the propaganda of our times, I would have seen England as too farmed, too crushed tight with humans and their history, soil too poisoned, forests too hurt and impoverished for such an education. better to turn to the vastness of Siberia or some other pristine wilderness. Thank God I didn't. The eye of the needle is everywhere, abiding patiently for you to quilt your life to the other world, which is really our deeply natural function anyway. Small pockets of absolute aliveness, greenness, riven deep mystery are all over our strange and bullishly magnificent isle. I first came across you in Devon, in Ebbecombe, when there was the West Country Storytelling Festival. And you were doing a piece. I can't remember the exact piece now, but it was just so... What I really remember from that time was how captivating it was. And I don't think I'd had much experience of being in front of an oral storyteller really before, sadly. You know, it's something that seems to have... become one of those things that, oh, you're a storyteller. It's like, I didn't know they existed anymore, you know, it's that kind of thing. And how did you come, I'm sure there's a long journey, but where does that start for you with story?
It starts really in a situation I'm now very grateful for, but I wasn't at the time, which is growing up in a house without a television. That's where storytelling comes from. Growing up in a house also without a phone or a car. And so this is in the early 70s. And so it's a closed, quite hermetic world. There was a big forest right behind my house. And a house full of books and a house with a mum and a dad who in their own way regarded language as a form of wealth. It was a kind of treasure. They'd sort of save us certain words, certain poems, certain stories. And so in some fashion, my fledgling imagination as a little child immediately moved out into images and to words and to nature without thinking too much about it. I was just flooded with it. And so in a way, I've always been a storyteller. I was talking to my daughter the other day about my wretched school reports, and they always said the same thing. They said this from 4 years old to, you know, 16. They said, he's a dreamer, he's a dreamer, he's a dreamer. And actually, in their fashion, they were right. But I've always believed, unfashionably, actually, that reverie can lead to participation. Reverie, in its deepest sense, has a kind of, oddly, like a moral. It opens a morality. It opens up the true north of the heart. And so actually, my dreaming, in a fashion, has shown me how to behave.
So reverie, when you talk about reverie, you're talking about as a sense of receptivity?
Yeah, I am. It's what James Joyce used to call aesthetic arrest. And that phrase really means, what are the moments in your life where you've been utterly claimed by something? Since I started to teach, one of the things that I'm most interested in is talking to students about things that not a taste, not something that you grew sophisticated enough to appreciate, like modern jazz necessarily, but something that just grabbed your heart. And it could be very simple. It could be a scent, it could be a color, it could be a piece of music. So that's really what I mean. Reverie, when you are in the presence of something that is bigger and more powerful than yourself. Rilke the poet is often saying in his work, what you really want is to be defeated by something. You want to be defeated, because actually our successes often make us small. And to be in the presence of great literature, stories, poems, a mountain, a river, a hawk over ocean, things like that should make you recalibrate your size in the bigger picture, but also not annihilate it. It's a strange rejigging, really.
Sure, like a kind of recognition of natural place or something, natural order.
Yes. I mean, my background as I got older, and this is really what leads to becoming a storyteller, is wilderness rites of passage, which we could talk about later. And it really means extended periods alone in the wild. And over a period of 4 days, something in you gets slowly whittled, slowly ground down. Again, not exactly as a form of diminishment, probably as a form of humbling. So that moment occurs that many mystical traditions refer to, and certainly indigenous cultures understand implicitly. You realize that psyche, or what you regard as soul, or the things you feel most deeply about, dwells not just inside you, but you dwell within it. Now, that's an easy move intellectually to make, but it's an astonishing move to make as a field of perception, a field of awareness.
Experientially, yeah.
Yeah. And so over the years, I've explored many different ways to refer to that. It's not even a belief. It's just a way of seeing, a way of beholding, I would call it. And the way that is most delightful to me to express it is through story. Because right. within story, especially old fairy tales, there will be moments in a story where it's not always a human narrative at the center. There'll be a moment where a woman becomes a magpie. Or you can't tell if the perspective of the outcome is coming from a waterfall or a lightning storm or raisins in the hand of a young child. And so, again, you get this sense of multiplicity. And to be able to express that through the generosity of storytelling seemed to me the most unbelievable secret that needed to be an open secret and needed to become public. So when I was probably in my late 20s and early 30s, I got really serious about it. And I really, I went from being more of a kind of raconteur in the pub or with families to somebody that actually wanted to curate language. I realized that my language was very damaged. And I wasn't helping anything by continuing to speak in this blunt, broken down manner. And so I just went and sat at the feet of some great teachers. I did my study. I stayed humble. And I would go through books with a little luminous pen. And every time I came across a great poet, I would find a line where the energy crests in the line. And I just underline it, and I'd spend a lot of time thinking about it. What's happening in the language that opens that door to what William Blake calls a pinprick of the eternal? Yeah.
That's a really interesting point that I want to just expand on, where you say about the language. You felt like your language was blunt, your blunt language,
yes.
that you've been, that you'd grown up speaking in this way, because you're, and the kind of, the job of the storyteller as a translator, as an in-between between what's going on in the world around us and the people who are the audience, you're kind of there needs to be a certain alteration of language for that translation to happen, because people just don't have the perception to have a direct, or sadly lack that kind of, these days a lot of people anyway are disconnected from nature, from the natural world. There's a disconnect in perception of these things, and you seem to be using language as an intermediary, so people can have that connection through the story.
Seamus Heaney has a lovely phrase. He says that we need to tune our ear. There's a kind of a tuning up required to appreciate, for example, good poetry. And I think the storyteller psychically tunes the ear of everyone in the room. And it doesn't mean, when I talk about language, it doesn't mean that suddenly you've swallowed a thesaurus. It's not that. It's just getting to grip with what the word eloquence means to you. And eloquence can be very straightforward, very simple, very hewn down. But in some manner, the teller has distilled something essential about themselves. In fact, really, when I'm watching storytellers, I tend to have a particular question at the back of my mind, and it's always the same. Is this person trying to tell the truth or not? Mm-hmm. And there's many ways to do that. And so, again, it's not... there are as many ways to tell a story as there are animals on the planet. Mm. You know, a heron shouldn't try and be a bear, and a wolf shouldn't try and be an otter. So it's good to sit there and feel the animal presences in you and the ecosystems within you and the volcanoes within you and the tundra within you and the red deserts of Arnhem Land and all of that, and get clear with your nature. And actually, for me, that takes a long time, and your nature will probably change a bit as you grow older. So a storyteller also isn't necessarily a fixed point. They are somebody in service to the imagination. There's a nice word, the imaginal, which really comes, we know about it a lot through a philosopher called Henry Corbin and the work of James Hillman. And the imaginal goes back to Neoplatonism. It goes back to this original idea about psyche, which says the earth thinks in a certain fashion. Water thinks, thunderclouds think, spiritual energies that we can't necessarily see think. And if, as Heaney says, there's a kind of tuning going on, we can enter the great thinking. In fact, we have those rare moments where you go, wow, I'm getting thought. I'm not thinking, I'm getting thought. And where I realize my own work is always trying to go, and often fails, where I'm trying to go is a place where I'm getting thought.
You're receiving inspiration, I guess. It's like a kind of a creativity channel.
In an old bardic sense of the word. Interestingly, inspiration itself is not the beginning and the end of the matter. Inspiration has to be tied into a kind of artfulness that can be expressed. If your let's call it your insight is not anchored in something that is nutritional to other people, other places, other animals, then there's a chance that it goes toxic in you. You think you've got the Holy Grail, but it becomes a kind of poison. So, for example, going out into the forest to dream and to pray, is the weight behind it all over the world is that actually you're not there for self-aggrandizement. You're not there really to figure out that bad thing that happened when you were six. You're there in service to the 10,000 secrets, and you come back. And the old bardic model was that you would then do the adult thing with the assumption that you don't just become an adult because we have beards or breasts. Actually, adults are made. You actually get made. There's a lot of people walking around who are not adults.
This is a really interesting thing when you're talking about you're talking about the lack of initiation, or there's a missing. There seems to be a bit of a missing phase in development, really, in our society these days, where the initiation rites are so skewed. We've got like Freshers' Week at university, or I don't know. A lot of it revolves around inebriation or. It's not a positive force, the initiation experience. It's not deep. It's just a kind of surface thing of like, well, this is what we go through. These are the hoops that we go through. And it doesn't make people. It kind of destroys them.
No. There's an anthropologist called Victor Turner. And Victor Turner did some very important work in the last century around what happens in a functioning initiation experience. I'm thinking of tribal groups that would say, for example, take you out into the desert or into a forest where you would go through a protracted period where you were severed from all your normal societal functions. Now, he calls that moment or moments or period, or actually really the Blakean thing I mentioned, pinpricks of the eternal. He describes it as entering what he calls the liminal.
Yep.
Which is becoming quite a phrase that I think people get quickly, which is really good. But he has a second phrase, which is not so well known, but it's very important for your question. If you experience that moment where you are temporarily blown open without the cultural understanding and holding of that as being in service, that the liminal isn't the end in itself. It's actually leading you into a period of maturation. If you don't get that third stage, that you don't, you get not the liminal, but the liminoid. Now, the liminoid, how many people have you met who have been through, you know, profound illness or divorce or trauma of some fashion? And it is clear whatever was gold in that experience has not yet distilled in them. I have friends, and we talk about this, who I would say are addicted to disorder in their lives. They're addicted to kicking the table over and saying, well, I'm done with that, I'm done with this, I'm done with her, I'm done with him, I'm done with this job, because the brief the brief hallucination of freedom is a glimpse of this deeper world they want to get to, but without the wider context to it, you're left with often, not always, by any means, this is not a generalization, but you can be left with, you know, the damage, but not the grace. Does that make any sense?
It does. I mean, you mentioned that, and it's something that I can resonate with quite strongly, because I had an illness experience when I was a young man, you know, barely on the cusp of adulthood. It was like a life or death situation. And it's, you know, I'm still trying to distill what the gold is in that. I feel like it's a long process.
I wouldn't presume for a second, I'm not somebody, these terribly irritating people that when you're going through something god awful says, well, this is just what you need. It's not that. However, how we choose to respond is another matter entirely. How we choose to respond.
We choose to respond in that moment and afterwards, you know, I think that...
So what you're saying, I find really interesting, that coming through something that deep, your dance with it, in a way, is something that is taking place over many years. It's not just something that can be, you know, compartmentalized into a paragraph.
No, but I mean, yeah, exactly. And that, for me, that's, you know, that's been quite an extreme version of the initiation experience. But it was almost so overwhelming at such a young age, where the integration side of things is just a very long road. I think that's probably natural. But I mean, with the kind of the indigenous, the more kind of where there's a trail of these practices in cultures, is this kind of a male thing or a female thing? Was it tending to be kind of biased towards the males?
First, I think the first thing to say is initiation is an enormous word. It describes, of course, a multiplicity of practices, many of which I know almost nothing about. The strand of it that I do have experience of is, as we say, you know, what I call a wilderness vigil. Now, no, I don't think that, although of course there are very particular initiatory practices for young women that young men never even know about. You know, they enter the mysteries of the aunts and the older women of the tribe, and the men go out and enter the mysteries and the holding of the older men. And that has always gone on, and as long as it can, I hope it continues. The practice of fasting in a wild place will vary culture to culture to some degree. Sometimes there'll be a bias towards the women doing it. Sometimes there'll be a bias towards the men. But certainly its revival in the last 40 or 50 years, which is in large part the Wilderness Vigil, the revival of it is in large part due to the work of a man called Stephen Foster and a woman called Meredith Little and the School of Lost Borders, who I personally owe a great deal to. They, as far as I can tell, by and large work with mixed groups, and I've always worked with mixed groups. So a village initiation may well involve something of solely one sex or another, but my experience of it in terms of the wilderness work is usually mixed groups.
So I have a friend who first introduced me to their work a few years ago when I was living with her, and also to there's a book called Soulcraft by Bill Plotkin, which is a fascinating, really inspiring book. It kind of touches on these themes as well as a lot of other stuff around ceremony and different ways of connection. I understand that you kind of took yourself off when we're going back.
I didn't. I went out. Are you asking about the first time I went out into
with your kind of origin of how you got into the wilderness fasting kind of experiences and then became subsequently a guide of these experiences?
I didn't do it on my own. I went out. Back in the days when you'd go to red phone boxes to ring people up, I went to a red phone box and I rang my friend Gavin, who lived in Edinburgh at the time. And he told me, he said, I'm going up to Wales. There's a small group of people and it's going to involve us, you know, walloped on the side of a terrifying hill for 4 days and nights. And it's being run by a man called David Wendelberry. And there's one place left. And I really desperately wanted to do it. I did do it.
And what age were you?
I was 23, I think.
So quite young.
Yeah. And despite the childhood that I have described to you, like anybody going through the kind of the grinder of adolescence, I'd forgotten a lot of it. Mm. And so by the time I ended up on this hillside, I think I struggled to put a tent up. I'd never made a fire, nothing like that. It just wasn't in me. And I felt something of a tourist. I did not feel kin, you know, to the buzzard. I did not feel kin to the Irish Sea. I did not feel kin to the meadow filled with wildflowers. I just felt like a kid in leather trousers on the side of a hill. I felt ridiculous. I felt like a baby, actually.
Yeah.
But that period then followed really probably 6 to 8 years of working in small crews with David and witnessing many, 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 many people go through this experience, from at-risk youth to people that were dealing with illness. People were going through all sorts of things. The thing that did tend to identify different folks going through it was they were usually in the presence of something substantial in their life. They were at a crossroads of some kind.
Sure.
And crossroads, as you know, that's usually where the gold in a story comes from.
Yeah.
So no, I went through a fairly rigorous and extensive training, I would say.
And then, so you then, is that something that was kind of developing alongside the story work? So
it was before.
Before the story
work. It was before. One of the things as a fervent reader, when I was, a lot of this period, I lived in a tent for 4 years on the side of a succession of different English hills.
This is around the same in your 20s?
Yeah, 20s and just cresting into my early 30s. Just sort of right on that Saturnian axis. One of the things I noticed, and this has been really significant for me, is that all the literature that referred to wilderness rites of passage would often have a kind of mythological garnish on the top of it. But I felt that the models they were really using to express the process were psychological.
Okay.
They'd mention the myth of Orpheus. They'd mention Buffalo Woman. They would mention Cú Chulainn, but they felt decorative. They felt decorative. And having gone through many variants of the vigil experience, for me, and only for me, I felt, no, that they're not decorative, they're it. And actually, an overly psychological model is the wrong model, is the wrong handrail to be gripping onto as you enter the mysteries.
Well, it's taking you further into your own brain.
I felt, and again, you know, only, I'm not saying this generationally, but I felt that it made you feel safe to a degree. It gave you some stability in a very uncertain experience. But actually what it did for me was a psychological model made it smaller, a mythological model made it bigger, more porous and more true. But when I looked round for the book that brought together wilderness rites of passage and myth in the way that I understood it, the book did not exist. So I wrote A Branch from the Lightning Tree with the entire remit of that book being, if I do nothing else, I want to make absolutely overt the relationship between myth and wilderness rites of passage. I was working, by this point, this is a few years later, I'm working, you know, four jobs, I'm earning, you know, tuppence a month, young child, all of that. No audience, no one's waiting for this book to come out. You know, I've talked to tens of people, you know, no one cares.
Yeah.
But I felt I had to do this thing.
Yeah. So you were still taking, this was a point where you were still heavily involved in the wilderness, fast taking the groups out.
Yes. I still am to a degree. The School of Myth, which is now coming into its 13th year.
Yeah.
What we're just coming to the end, actually, over the last few years, I've trained up three really wonderful people to actually continue that work, and I do less of it now, and we have a whole team.
Right.
So I was doing it, and I recognised that I was not equipped to spend all my time at the coalface of that experience. I was not to be working with group after group after group after group after group of people going through that. It's very intense. And actually what I wanted to do was explore this edge, which I've just described to you, where myth, the aliveness of myth, not as something referring to a long time ago, but myth as a living, playful, difficult presence in our lives. I wanted to explore that. And by then I was telling orally more and more stories and picking up, to my astonishment, an audience that had no knowledge of my background, no knowledge of anything other than the story in the room at that point. And that had a kind of a life to it that took off. And before I knew it, I was meeting people like Robert Bly in America and starting to teach all over the shop.
So are you still teaching internationally, or is that something you've kind of scaled down with?
No, I still do it. I founded and led the fairy tale and oral traditions courses at Stanford University. I'm the principal teacher at the Great Mother Conference in Maine every year, where we've got people like David Abram and Paul Kingsnorth and many others coming this year. No, I get about.
Yeah, talking of get about, I recently picked up a copy of your latest book, Scatterlings. Mm. And wow, it's a powerful piece of work, very powerful. I'm only maybe a quarter of the way through, but already even just the first kind of main essay, which I think is republished on your website, it seemed there are parallels, the small gods, I think. It just made me question a lot of things instantly, and it made me slow down. It made me kind of, it feels like the way that you chose to, the way that you express your ideas and the language you choose to do that with, you can't read that in the way that you read other books, it felt to me. I was kind of like, this doesn't feel like a normal, this doesn't feel like every other book that I pick up. This is something that demands to be savored. And I really feel like a lot of books that you get these days, the depth of connection with the author in that way is really missing. So thank you for putting that out into the world. I'm really enjoying it. And how did you, how was the process around working from, going from the kind of oral tradition, the more kind of expressive, you're in a room with people. How was the transition from that to writing down words on a computer or, you know, on paper for an audience that you can't see?
Well, they're different disciplines. And fairly frequently, you know, one has the experience of meeting a writer, maybe when they're giving a public performance and or a public talk, and you think, oh, that's why they're a writer. You know, that's clearly what they're really good at. And I'm not saying I'm a really good writer, but I oddly straddle both. And again, in this first book, A Branch from the Lightning Tree, the epilogue to the book is all about the relationship between orality and literature. They are really different. And this is what I would say, actually. And again, this is, sort of unfashionable in a way. When I'm teaching, i.e. telling stories of public, I'm pushing energy out into the world. Mm-hmm. I'm pushing energy out. And I feel the depletion to a degree when I've finished.
Right.
You know, it's a deep process. But when I'm writing, energy is coming into me.
Interesting.
Especially when it's hermetic. I write best when I have had the house physically empty of other people for a few days. I'm gathering an ancestral conversation around me. And that ancestral conversation, what Jung calls the lament of the dead, to hear that conversation, I need physical space. I can't be surrounded by people and lights and deadlines and wires, you know. So to write is a kind of a gathering in. Writing also helps me figure out to some extent how I think. So when I started sending manuscripts out to publishers years ago, you know, universally the feedback was like, don't write in the way that you write, just don't, because no one will read it. It's horrible. But I knew I wanted to write in a way that secreted in the language was little areas where the old gods could nest and sleep and be refreshed, and strange little dryads and naiads could erupt from the soil of my thoughts and then back down into the earth. I wanted to do something that maybe had a small readership, but I was prepared, as I say in Scatterlings, to trade growth for depth. I wanted to write deeply while I'm here. You know, I wanted to write with weight, and I wanted to write at the edge of my own understanding. And I can't do that if I'm breaking everything down into bullet points. I don't like writing about... I'm sick, actually. I am sick of hearing people using tame language to approach wild things, because again, it's an incorrect handrail. Stop gripping onto it, because I don't think it feeds. You know what I learned in the tent, in those years in the tent, is that our language, our behaviour, there are many eyes on us, not just human, and so the way we present ourselves, the choices we make, they are significant. Religion is correct in that manner. But I wanted to write these Gnostic deep books. And in a way, I'm also playing with time and history when I write. I'm also writing to the younger versions of myself. Mm. I'm writing to me at 19. I'm writing to me. Actually, I would not have wanted to read these books any younger than 19. But I'm writing to keep myself alive through other periods that I've already lived through. And I wonder if the reason I lived through and survived those periods is because I'm now sending those books and that information back to that kid.
Mm.
So that's my perspective on it.
Mm. Fascinating. Yeah, yeah. I mean, it really comes across when you read this. It doesn't feel like... it doesn't feel like the work of somebody who's... you can feel your explanation of yourself in the words. You can feel the depth of experiences that you've gone to. The connection that you've fostered with the more than human world is very present and very enlivening for people to read, I think. And one of the points that I think is a bit key, where you just touched on there, where you're talking about the treading depth. I can't remember what you said now, treading growth for depth. And that's, you touch on that again when you talk about being of a place rather than from a place. Mm. And that's something that I find really fascinating as an idea. I think people are very quick to say that they're from a place. And the what that means doesn't really have much weight. And I really value that kind of that distinction of being of a place. And it really made me think, you know, when have I actually been of a place, and am I of a place now? And how am I living in the place where I live, and what's my relationship to the place where I live? And this idea of being of a place and having a dialogue with a place, it tends to me that the dialogue between myself and the land is easier when there are less people around. And also when the land is wilder and less tamed by humans, it speaks loudly. And I had this experience when I was living in North Wales for a period in this valley, that was my one of the places that, as I was reading your book, it made me think, this is one of the places that I really felt like I was of. And I walked a lot, I communed with the land a lot. There's like waterfalls, mountains, stone circles. There's a lot of richness right on your doorstep. And I wonder how do people find that if they live in a city? And how do they engage with the wild and the natural world if they're, as most, you know, a majority of people do these days, live in these kind of urbanized, humanized kind of environments?
Well, that's not easy. It's not easy for a start. And I'm very, very sympathetic to anybody reading the book saying, well, listen, buddy, I don't have Dartmoor National Park on my doorstep. I have, you know, Croydon or Detroit. Or, you know, Kyoto or something. Mm. Well, first of all, I've mentioned him once or twice, so I'll mention him again. You know, Blake found most of what he knew and needed in, you know, in London. Certainly when I started doing this kind of work, I was also living in London.
And
the thing that I elected to do was not to be sizist around the wild.
Right.
Not to sit there hyperventilating about the fact that I don't have 400 acres of old growth forest on my doorstep. But actually, if I could really pay attention to the so-called weeds that were growing outside my door, or that small little park in Broccoli that I would go to every day, and that particular tree I would sit underneath, I made the rash assumption that the living world still wanted to disclose something to me.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lovely idea by a philosopher who everyone should read called Gaston Bachelard. Bachelard says, in some weird way, the world wants to be admired. So if do nothing else, start admiring things, for God's sake. Stop stop bemoaning your own supposed lack of liberty and just retune yourself to actually making, you know, a rowan tree blush. You know, just change your pattern of poor me. And so, okay, from the moment I set foot outside my house today to the moment I come back, in some small way, I am going to pay attention to more than the phone that is buzzing in my pocket, or to more than the expectations of my job or my friends. And so actually that's what I did. And this is, in a fairy tale language, this is what they would call picking up plum cake, you know, crumbles. What's it when a cake is...
Crumbs.
Yeah, picking up the crumbs of a plum cake through the forest. So you don't know your way. Mm. A lot of people, you know, are saying, well, I don't know my way and I'm waiting for the eagle to come and land on my shoulder and tell me. Stop thinking about the eagle and pay attention to that little ladybird or that crumb that's in front of you, because it's the crumbs, one by one, diligently collected, or the grains separated, like the story of Psyche and Eros, the seeds separated in the dark. They're the things that lead you towards, you know, frankly, what your snuffling nature is trying to procure in your life, you know. So if you're living in a city, attend to small things. See where that takes you for a start.
And it goes back to what we were saying earlier about perspective, changing perspective. Mm. Whereas if you're appreciative of, you know, like you say, the particular tree that you go to every other day, or the creatures that are living around you, like you, the way that you look at the world and your place in the world changes, and it doesn't have to matter so much whether you're in a city to appreciate those things.
You make different decisions. That's what it comes down to. You make different decisions. You know, the heart is moved. There's a phrase I repeat a lot that the troubadours used to kind of come back to, the educated heart. So that's really, in terms of my own students these days, wherever you're living, you know, educate your heart. You know, it's there to be, it's to be an organ of perception. And you make different decisions with an educated heart. You make different decisions when a world is in full disclosure to you. You make different decisions when, in your few years here, you believe that you're part of it, that actually there's, you know, there's a sense of that wonderful word vocation moving through you, you know.
Mm. Mm. So you mentioned earlier that the School of Myth is 13 years old. Mm. Did you say something like that?
Yeah.
And so when did that form, how did that kind of birth, what kind of gave birth to that?
Well, really what gave birth to it was, by now I was coming to the end, I think, of the kind of the vigil training, let's call it. And I was living in the tent and I met up with a friend, you know, and I was not like Thoreau, you know, when I was in this tent. It was not like I never wanted to see anybody again or any of that stuff. It was just something that I had to do. But I met up with a friend in the pub. And this was when there was a kind of a lot of people, life coaches were on the scene. And he said, I really don't know what's going on in my life. And I'm going to take my money and I'm going to give it to a life coach. And I was so appalled and so furious with him. I said, if you give me a fraction of that, you could come down to where I live, come down to the tent. And for 2.5 days, I'll give you everything I got. In terms of mythology, poetic thought, but more than anything else, really time out on the land. And so he and two others, one of whom remains with me to this day as part of my team, David Stevenson, they gathered, and for a year they came to the tent every 8 weeks, and they also went up to Wales and fasted on the hill, went very deep into the thing, and that's simply how it began.
Wow, that's so incredible that you had people willing to kind of join you and to kind of to be taken on a journey, to be willing to be taken on that journey around
yeah.
you.
Yeah, and these were the days where you went round with, you know, you put posters up. There was no social media.
Yeah.
You know, there you just put posters up, one poster in one bookshop, and hoping to God somebody sees it while they're wandering in buying their, you know, Aleister Crowley tarot set or whatever the hell it is. Yeah. And, you know, I had one phone call and this guy said, yeah, I'm quite interested. Maybe I'm coming. How much is it? Yeah. Is there a concessionary rate? You know, all the usual stuff. And yes, that's how it began. And I clearly remember at the end of the first night of the first weekend, kind of sitting out in the dark once they were settled in a sleep, because they just come and sleep in the tent, you know, and I'd come down in the morning and I'd throw towels on them. This is about 5:45 in the morning, and we go down, and it would begin in January, and we go down and we'd swim in old English rivers. It was bracing.
Yeah.
But I remember sitting out in the dark thinking, well, okay, I got through, I survived 3 hours of doing this. You know, maybe I can survive another few hours tomorrow. And that's always how it's been. But my attitude, and this is partially just out of the family that I come from, my attitude is prayerful. Mm-hmm. So I really, really want the best for the folks that come. And hubristic though I can sometimes be, underneath that is underpinning really a desire to pass something of nourishment on.
And did that feel like a natural process when you began doing that? Because, I mean, did you plan? Did you just talk?
Oh, no, I planned. I used to plan. I hadn't at that point realised how important stories were going to be. I certainly didn't present myself as a storyteller at that point.
So you were teaching before you were storytelling?
Yes, I think I was. I mean, I don't have the notes. I can't really remember. And what I would have done, I'm sure, which goes back to the beginning of our conversation, is I would have begun with poems. Poems in the, you know, the language of D.H. Lawrence or the language of Emily Dickinson or the language of Lorca, when they land in a room, they send your soul the message that we are leaving the time of school runs and phone calls and texts. We're leaving all of that and we're going to this other place. And so I know I would have begun, I'd love to find the notes from that first weekend, but I can't. I know I would have begun with poems. I know I would have then probably begun the roots of a story. The idea for the school comes from an old Irish phrase called a hedge school. And partially what a hedge school was is it's as literal as it sounds. You would have a bit of tarp hanging off a hedge. And in times of great famine or furore in the country, in a small community, if you had a skill set, if there was something that you could teach, whatever the hell it was, you were sort of entrusted to teach it. And so that school in those early wild days was just trying to do that. And then over the years that moved along, it really became clear that the thing that we did that was really unique was this attention on stories.
Fascinating. That reminds me, there was a phrase that I saw in an article that you'd written when you were talking about, can we not be ourselves like a tavern filled of interesting strangers, which I really like. And then there's a thing where you say, you know, run 3-week courses from our porch on the relationship between Aztec temples and gypsy gambling games from medieval Wales.
There is a link. That's real. There's a link.
Such a great, a great concept. And I love that about the tavern filled with interesting strangers. And I guess a lot of people are unaware of those aspects within themselves. And it's this kind of work which can help uncover these people that live within them.
People and animals, and as I said, weather patterns, the whole game. And that's not an anthropocentric thing. It's just a religious thing. It's a soulful thing. So a couple of things I'd like to say about that is, one, going back to the way that I write books, I presume on the intelligence of the reader. So I'm not trying to dumb things down. I'm trying to raise things up. for a start. So when I'm saying, you should try this, you should try this, you should, I'm trying to provoke. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to grab the throat of some wild little genius introvert living in Prestatyn to say, listen, Rhiannon, or listen, Jim, you friggin' matter. You matter.
Yeah.
And actually, those strange confluences of passion you have, they're not abstract. Maybe you were designed before you were even born into the intrigues of your family. Maybe there was something you had to do with this life. Now, proceed. Proceed. So that's what those books are meant to be about. And so this notion that maybe inside you there is a tavern of interesting strangers, this is a response to, you know, the political nature of our times, where, as I'm saying at the moment, when a border is closed, become a frontier, because borders are actually boring. A frontier is much more porous, is much more of a crossroads. It's not a guy with a passport. It's, as we described, it's a tavern. Now, so if inside you, in what we call, you know, using a big S, the self, there are all these different beings, impulses, dream systems, and here's the rub, they all want different things from you. So every time, you know, New Year's Day comes around and I'm thinking, well, you know, there's absolutely no way that I'm going to drink whiskey for at least 6 months. Down in my cellar is this wild old babushka smoking her cigars, sitting on a bucket. And she's saying, well, no one ever told me about that. And so my babushka comes forward and she, you know, she dictates a whole other set of terms. Now, mythic intelligence, telling stories, working with the language and the thoughts and the conversations of the ancestors and the ones that are come to come, knowing that time is not a straight line, all of this means that you will start to talk to and nourish all these different warring influxes in you. They want different things from you. That's what I notice. And so you're going around with your little lamp, and, you know, imagine that you're walking down into yourself with a little lantern saying, cooey, anybody there? Think of the round table, you know, think of Arthur, think of Camelot. Mm. For most folks I know at the moment, if I said, close your eyes, maybe the people that are listening to this would do this, you know, close your eyes, see that great round table of Arthur that is in you. Who's at your table? Who's still there? Who's left?
And then it's kind of welcoming those people in.
Welcoming those beings, yeah.
Getting
welcoming
to know
those
them.
Beings. What, and, you know, a question you could again ask is, you know, in what temples do you serve in your life? To call back into your daily being, these kinds of presences and powers that usually polite culture has made you send into exile, they may want different forms of libation. So the gods are not meant to be working on our behalf, frankly. I find that a little off. You know, they're not abstractions. They have not just become, you know, our diseases or our psychological motifs. These are living, powerful presences that move in and through us. If you're a storyteller, if you actually start giving language to these beings, then you very quickly realize that you can't speak of them wryly as a kind of metaphorical exercise. You've got to be respectful. You know, you're telling their stories. You know, Hillman used to say, actually, he said, I think we got it wrong. The gods are not our dreams. We are the dream of the gods. And the problem is that most of us, we're giving the gods nightmares now. And B, maybe our lives are not even tinged with enough magic to become a dream for a god, you know.
It almost feels like you're becoming one of these mythological characters that you're kind of documenting in the Scatling's book. You know, you're kind of building up this work, which feels so relevant. And
I hope when I look back, when I look back at those books, those three books, because they really are a triad, Lightning okay. Tree and Snowy Tower and Scatterlings, stories that are in there are around my own life are not there. I'm not, you know, playing a trumpet for myself, but I know that if I was reading it, that would be useful to me to go, oh, okay, well, if he did it, and he's open about how he did it, and these are the threads that nourished him, maybe I can start to develop something like that. So I am in a position, like I think many people are in early middle age, to try and be, you know, a good teacher as well as a good practitioner. That's all I'm trying to do.
It's unlocking doors for people, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And stories, Jaguars, Tundra, Longships, Yggdrasil, the World Tree, all of it arrives much more swifter in you when you give it a place beautiful enough for it to land. You know, we've got to stop auditioning gods. We've got to stop auditioning stories. We've got to stop auditioning the ancestors. Yeah, I could go on, but I won't.
Yeah, maybe that's a good place to wind up. Martin, thank you so much for your time today. If people want to check out your work online or find out more about you, your books, where do they go?
There's a website called drmartinshaw.com, and that's got essays and some recordings and an interview. And then for the school, schoolofmyth.com. And in terms of the masters, go to the Schumacher website. Okay.
There you go. Martin, thank you very much.
Pleasure.
Hope you enjoyed that conversation. Thank you for your time. Thank you for your ears. If you want to help us out, you can send the link, share the link around some friends of yours you think might enjoy it, post it on social media, anything like that would be greatly appreciated so we can spread the love. And a quick thank yous, as always, to Six Organs of Admittance for the lovely music that we hear at the beginning and the end of this show. And you can find out more about them at sixorgans.com. And the music is released by Drag City Records out of Chicago. And you can check out their website at dragcity.com. Soon it will be spring. Soon it will be spring. But here in the UK, we're just waking up to warmer weather and the return of the green shoots and leaves, and the world seems to be waking up again. Another spring, another bright season ahead. I hope you'll join me in a couple of weeks' time for another episode of the Lumieres podcast.
We found our way, the light.